So following this 2 days of flying in July of 63 on the Sea King again down at Sikorsky, you returned to Shearwater and VX-10 again, flying fixed-wing aircraft as a test pilot for the squadron.
I was flying, flying the Tracker, the Bell, and the Horse, and the H-04S.
So VX-10 was still doing trials with both the Bell and the S-55?
I wasn't at that time. I was just, doing sequences, just getting myself back to flying in the Bell and the Horse.
Oh, I see.
And flying projects in the Tracker. And in August, I was doing some working on a project with the Horse. One of the projects for VX-10.
Which project would have that been for the Horse?
Looks like for the Horse is PD-114, which I haven't got any. Can't remember what that was about.
All right.
I'd have to look up, and that may be in that VX-10 book.
All right.
In September, flew down to Patuxent River. 28th of September, and on the 30th of September, 27th of September, flew down to Patuxent River after being involved in project work with both the Horse and the Tracker. And on 28th of September, Sosnikowski and I, Sosnikowski is first pilot, flew 4003 on a test flight for 2.4 hours.
Did you at any time in this period have to go back to Patuxent River to be checked out as a test pilot for helicopters? You had already done it for fixed-wing aircraft.
No.
No?
No. I believe by this time, Saz had completed his test pilot course at Patuxent River, and I'm not sure whether he flew them. I can't remember whether he actually flew them in one of their flight test organizations there or not.
Right.
But that was the first time I had flown with him in some time. And up until the period of time that we've just talked about, I hadn't flown with him, although I knew him. This was the first time I'd flown with him.
Was he also in VX-10 at this time?
I can't say for sure. I have to presume that he was.
All right. When did you return to Sikorsky to fly the helicopter, the first helicopter for VX-10 back to Shearwater?
Well, we flew it back. We tested it on the 28th of September, and we started the trip back on the 30th of September.
September. And that would have been
I believe we went to the... That's when those pictures were flying over Long Island.
Right.
New York City. And flew up to BDR. I can't remember what BDR was, but I think that was probably Bridgeport, Connecticut. So we flew from Pax River to Bridgeport on the 30th of September.
And then the next day from Bridgeport, Connecticut to Shearwater?
No, that was 30th of September, Pax to Bridgeport, and October the 11th we flew from Bridgeport to Dell Air Force Base in Maine, and then that was 2.3, and then we flew from Dell Air Force Base to Shearwater 2.2. So on the October the 11th we flew from Bridgeport to Dow and Dow to Shearwater.
What was the normal cruising speed for the Sea King helicopter? About 90 knots, would that be about right?
I can't really remember. I thought it was up around 120, but I may be wrong.
All right. What would
or
be?
Maybe a little lower. 110, 120, I think. But I, as I say, I up to this time, I've had all of 20 hours
in the aircraft.
In the Seeking.
Right.
So.
So when you got the aircraft back to Shearwater, how soon after did VX-10 start their trials with the aircraft?
October the 11th, 4 days later, Saz and I did local flying in it in 4003 and PD-102, 1.5 hours.
So PD-102 was the project directorate for the haul down trials?
I believe it was, but I'd have to.
And there was a number of components to the PD-102.
Yeah, I think there were. Yeah.
So do you remember when you first started trials with the Sea King and Assiniboine?
I am not positive because my next flight with Saz Nikoski, that was October the 11th, sorry, 15th, PD-102, local PD-102, and November the 4th, Saz Nikoski and myself, flew that day, and November the 5th, we flew that aircraft, PD-102, 1.6 and 1.3 hours respectively, and but I never recorded anything specifically about those trips other than it was PD-102.
Right.
I could only presume because I had a thing about there are people putting deck, there's a column in here, deck landings.
Right.
As passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a thing, having had about 400 deck landings the hard way, people were putting in deck landings as landing on a Sea King on the back of a ship.
Right.
And I didn't think that was a deck landing,
proper
one. So I never recorded it.
So you were thinking in terms of
fixed wing. So I was thinking in terms of fixed wing arrested landings.
Right, okay.
Whereas this was the easy way of landing the thing. At that time it was the easy way of landing a helicopter on the flight deck of a ship which was anchored in the basin, which nothing was moving.
Right.
So I was very loath to do that. And that was November the 4th and the 5th, I flew with Saz, both those days, PD-102. And December the 5th, I flew two flights with Saz, PD-102. And December the 17th, I flew with him, 2.5 hours. And that was it.
All right.
That was it. Sum total of my work with the Sea King, other than later years when I was a senior test pilot in XO, I would fly in a Sea King as a second pilot or when we're flying up to Montreal to deliver aircraft or something like that, but I was never involved in project work after
right.
that because I was involved in mostly with the tracker.
Okay. Now you refer to the free deck landings aboard the destroyer out in Bedford Basin as the easy way, and fixed wing on the carrier with the arrestor wires as the hard deck landing. From looking at all the photographs, there doesn't appear to be very much room between the tip of the rotor blade and the superstructure of the hangar when you're landing. That must have been somewhat of a tense time from a pilot's perspective.
Well, I suppose so. It's the limitation of flying a helicopter as opposed to a fixed-wing aircraft. In a fixed-wing aircraft, you drive the airplane at the runway and move the controls in the right way to get it safely at the right end of the runway. Down on the ground, whereas in the helicopter, you're constrained by the fact that you're very aware of motion relative to the ground and what your clearance is. Now, the wing tips are painted, or the rotor tips are painted to a degree which give you an gives you some indication of your arc from sitting in the cockpit saying, well, ship, you know, I'm crazy if you go any closer than this. You also had your position that you knew on the flight deck relative to something at the side of you. You say, well, I go, you know, I'm 6 feet back, or I forget what the clearance was, it was 6 or 8 feet. You know, if I go any further, I'm going to be that much closer, and if I go too much further than that, I'm going to start nibbling away on something with the rotor tips.
Right.
So
when you say 6 to 8 feet clearance, was that from the tip of the rotor blade to the hangar?
Yeah, or any obstruction. But it may have been considerably more than that. But to me, it seems like that was about it at the time. Although it could have been more. It could have been 10 feet. As I say, I can't remember.
All right.
A long time ago.
Now, perhaps you can sort of take us through the procedure for not being hooked up and hauled to the deck, but some of these free deck landings aboard Assiniboine in Bedford Basin. Obviously, there was the LSO in his position would have been there for any landing, whether it was free deck or being hauled down. You've got the pilot and the co-pilot, and you're in radio communication with the LSO. But perhaps you can sort of walk us through the approach and the landing in terms of procedures and what's going on in the cockpit and what's going on between the cockpit and the LSO.
To be quite honest with you, I really don't remember. For instance, when they had the LSO in what they used to call the Howda, it must have been there at the time, but I can't remember where it was, or whether the guy was just crouched down over the edge of the flight deck with the radio in communication with the guy saying, yes, the pilot saying, you know, you're clear to land, and then give you instructions as to whether he thought you were doing something stupid or not. But essentially, we just made our approach straight in toward from astern of the ship, fly up to it. Or there were some approaches you'd fly in to the side and then stop. In fact, probably that was the safest way, and that's how we first started doing it. Parallel the ship's course, if you had imagined it was on course. Let's say, I don't know. I wasn't involved. You know, so you know you're in the right position beside the ship, and then just slide over.
All right.
To the side.
Okay.
I can't recall whether that was the way we started doing it, or whether we just started coming directly up the stern on the imaginary course of the ship and flying. I'd come up over slowly, you know, slowing down as you come up, and then just come to a stop over the stern where you knew you were clear, and then just creep forward until you knew you were in the right spot and just bring it down.
All right. Would that have been the first time that you flew aboard a small flight deck on the stern of a destroyer, I assume?
Oh, yeah.
Very first time.
The first time, yeah.
So it is a pretty small flight deck considering the size of the aircraft.
Oh, it is a pretty small flight deck, but going back to deck landings on carriers, were you coming in at 120 knots,
mm-hmm.
And the margin for error is very slim because we're on very small ships. And prior to that, I'd been aboard 4 different carriers and had a couple accidents in the bargain about three or four different types of aircraft. So it was four different types of aircraft. So it was a different experience, but to me at the time, it wasn't, that's what I say, it was no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I didn't put them in, log them as a deck landing. I thought, shit, this is deck, you know. The guys were saying, well, I've got 100 deck landings. I said, yeah, okay, what end? Oh, that's not deck landing. Minor, that's, you know, that's just, there used to be big competitions back in the dark days between helicopter pilots and fixed-wing pilots, or fixed-wing pilots and fighter pilots, you know.
Right. The normal the self friendly competition.
Self-inflated opinion of oneself and one's ability, of course.
Right. Okay, I have to stop the tape here for a second. So when you first landed aboard Assiniboine and she was anchored out in Bedford Basin, I assume the weather was near perfect conditions, but you were landing on board the deck without the benefit of the haul-down cable and the bear trap. So the only thing that kept the Sea King from sliding around the deck, if there was even a slight swell on the water, would have been the brakes of the aircraft itself until she could be put in the chocks by the aircraft handlers. Would that be accurate?
I think you're quite right by saying that. All they had down was, I think at the time, just non-skid paint. And you just, like any other metal surface, like the carrier, you just... once you got your wheels on the ground, you would, with the cyclic down, of course, you had the pressure from the rotor was, you know, a negative lift was holding you on the flight deck as well as the jumping on the brakes until they could put the chocks in and lash you down.
Right.
Tie down. And it's only then, you know, if you're going to shut down, of course, you have the tie-downs on as well.
So that would be a fairly quick process for the aircraft handlers to get the chocks out and the, and,
oh, yeah,
and the
it was,
lashings?
It was seconds, you know, because they were trained to dart in around the wheels and under aircraft. That was their life, and they did it marvelously well. I admire them because... I'm working off the carrier. Those guys would dash around in the middle of the night and all the rest of it, and slipping and sliding, and just to make sure you didn't go anywhere.
Right, because you don't want a 20,000-pound aircraft sliding around the deck.
No.
And off the side. So what, as the co-pilot during the landing procedure, what were your specific responsibilities? Were you an extra set of eyes for the pilot as well during the landing, in addition to the LSO, to deal with the clearances and obstructions and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, of course, you could see on your side, so you could have an indication, and you're in, with your intercom radio, you're in constant, always in touch with the rest of the crew, so you could tell the pilot, you know, what you were thinking. Well, most people didn't want to be interrupted. Ed Sosnikowski was fairly dogmatic about being, when he was sitting in the first pilot seat, you didn't want any interference from anybody.
Right.
So, you're just back up on the controls, and if there was an emergency, you're backing up an emergency, essentially, and act as just like another pair of eyes.
When you said that he didn't want too much communication between yourself and him as the pilot, was that just an individual thing, a peculiarity of any particular pilot?
No,
for
I think
example?
A lot of people who were sort of first pilot or captain of the aircraft would insist that, you know, what things were going to be done their way, and didn't want any interference from anybody else. And that was essentially, most people were like that. Some people were more than others, of course. But the tendency would be is that, you know, there were functions that a co-pilot had to do, backup throttles, this sort of thing, and do certain things in case of an emergency. And you just did your job, and that's what you're expected to do.
Do you have any recollections taking part in exercises or trials, more importantly, trials, local trials off of Halifax with the Sea King helicopter in Assiniboine, as opposed to being anchored in Bedford Basin?
I have no recollections other than from a management point of view, and even then the recollections are pretty dim as to what problems were being experienced with the trials in the course of the trials, and the many different trials, you know, like the horizon bar and problems with chasing all over the North Atlantic looking for heavy weather to do the heavy weather trials, and the involvement that the X-10 was in and the engineers in making modifications to make the system work. And in fact, I think the X-10 didn't get enough credit for making the system work to bring it to operational fruition, whereas nobody else was doing that at all. You know? You have things like hot refueling that they started in Bonaventure. Nobody else was doing that. We developed the procedures. When you say
hot refueling, that means that the engines are running and they're refueling at the same time. So this is to speed up or increase the operational efficiency.
Yeah, speed up the, and you do a crew. Sometimes you do a crew change, or sometimes you do it in the air. Start first in the air, and then you do a crew change on deck with hot refueling. Of course. Starting up and shutting down were the two times where things sometimes went unserviceable. So if you keep the bloody thing running,
mm-hmm.
then the chances were of something going unserviceable were lessened. And so you do a crew change, hot refuel, crew change, and off again, and the aircraft just keep going.
And these were all things that VX-10 was working on?
These were involved in, yeah, in the trials. And I wasn't involved in any of them.
Right. Okay. You had mentioned earlier in the tape that one of the qualities that all navies and all test pilots have to have is the ability to concentrate and conduct their flying trials and write everything down so that information can be used later as they work through the trials process. Did you have to write any reports while you were co-pilot with the Joe Sosnikowski, as it related to the Sea King helicopter trials, that you can remember?
No, I don't think I was required to get involved in any report writing of that.
Perhaps you could speak more generally. I mean, how are these fairly detailed reports that would be filed by the test pilots that could be used by the engineers?
Yeah. We had probably half and half. But the air engineers or electrical engineers were writing reports as project officers, and as well as pilots. And they were quite detailed and quite thick voluminous reports in a lot of cases.
So these reports that were filed by the test pilots would also complement instrumentation that may have been fitted in an aircraft like the Sea King to carry out certain measurements like an oscillograph or something like that to measure vibration in the rotor head. So you put the tapes from the oscillograph together with what the information the test pilot is providing.
Have you ever seen one?
An oscillograph?
No, I've never seen a report.
No, I have not.
Well, I think I've got one.
All right, we'll just stop. Following your time with Joe Sosnikowski flying the Sea King aboard Assiniboine, which were the free deck landings, did you have an occasion to be hooked up to the cable and to be hauled down to the deck?
No, I don't believe I did.
Did you ever have the occasion to be hooked up and hauled down after the trials at any time with the RCN?
No. No, I didn't. All I had, my only involvement really with Sea Kings after that was an accident investigation where on one occasion I remember flying in they had a hurried meeting to fly up to Ottawa with some engineering people, and I went along to present the case when the sponson failed. And the Sea King rolled over on its side, which led to the strengthening of the sponsons supporting the helicopter. And then in the early 70s, I was in the director of flight safety in Ottawa, where
my responsibility was for Sea Kings, as well as other helicopters and the tractor, and they call my shop the mud shop, because I had two Army guys working with me, and I was the Navy guy, and we investigated accidents, and I was involved in a few Sea King accidents at that time,
and
as far as accident investigation was concerned.
Right, and this was early 1970s.
Yeah, 72 to 75.
So the aircraft then would have been about anywhere from 9 to 13 years old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was well into the DDH cycle.
Right. Okay. Do you have any recollections or observations on VX-10? What were your impressions of the personnel, both the test pilots and the engineers, as it relates to any of the projects that they undertook, or specifically the DDH and the helicopter trials? I have the impression that they were all very well qualified and very keen individuals.
Oh, there were very dedicated and knowledgeable people involved in the trials. People like Peter Charlton and guys like that were just phenomenal. And also some of the chiefs that I remember at the time, squadron chiefs. It was a great squadron. And even though you had some of the individuals who were mostly concerned with helicopter operations, primarily the Sea King and the associated trials, the many trials, different trials and phases of trials that they went through, the fixed people who flew primarily fixed wing as opposed to those who flew the rotary wing got along well together, and there were very few jealousies or animosities. It's certainly not about what they were doing or whether one was doing more than the other was doing. Everybody had lots to do, lots of work for everybody.
How would you characterize the relationship between VX-10 and HS-50, the helicopter squadron? I'm sure that there must have been some contact or liaison between the two squadrons. They had entirely different roles to perform, but I'm sure that HS-50 had a vested interest in what VX-10 was doing as it related to a specific aircraft.
You would assume that there had been quite a bit of cooperation between two squadrons, and I assume that there was. I can't really recall any special relationships involved, or any really severe disagreements that we had. I think our biggest disagreements as far as the Sea King were concerned was the occasional conflicts with Ferry Aviation when they were in business, and the conflicts we inevitably had with headquarters, either in the Atlantic Command or in Ottawa. It was, I remember thinking at the time that I couldn't understand how they could have accepted the helicopter into service with the Canadian Navy without investigating, or the fact that the undercarriage was under design for our job. And this is what we found out when the sponson started breaking, that they waived the specifications as far as side loads were concerned, and that was just one of the things I recall, trying to wonder how that ever happened when we had technical people around and test pilots around who supposedly knew what they were doing at the time.
All right, we'll just stop the tape here and just put the next one in.
Cool.